CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talk's business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool in business. And every Sunday we look at issues affecting Liverpool and the wider northwest region. Today I'm going to focus on the business of football. The Deloitte Money League was released this week and Liverpool are a healthy ninth in the wealth stakes. But outside of the top dozen clubs in the world, how stable are clubs financially? I'll be asking how the powers that be will react to the Harry Redknapp trial, and we'll get the ball out for 5 minutes to talk about who might succeed Fabio Capello in the England job. Beyond the beautiful game and closer to home, Liverpool City Council, as expected, approved proposals that will see the city have its first elected mayor in May. Lorraine Rodgers resigned as the chief executive of the Mersey Partnership, and it looks like, after much to-ing and fro-ing, a new turnaround facility will be here for the summer. In the studio with me to discuss this today, football finance expert Professor Tom Cannon and our downtown events manager Roger Jonas. Good morning, chaps.
Good morning.
Tom, I'll come to you first. Obviously, the finances of football are something that have exercised your mind for many years now. I described there in the introduction Liverpool in a healthy ninth in the wealth stakes, but actually I understand that they've fallen down that particular league table, so maybe not as good news if first appears.
It's a mixed picture. It's good to be in the top 10, particularly when you're not in the Champions League, and this year, of course, not in any European competition, so Deloitte's are forecasting that Liverpool will slip another place or two. So it's good in terms of performance, but it's not moving in the right direction. And of course, Everton are in the top 30, which is also a very strong performance. They've got the best part of €100 million of income. I think it's over €90 million of income. So that's also a thing to note, is that Everton and Liverpool are in the top 30 clubs in Europe and both in the top 10 in England.
I suppose people will be more surprised at the fact that Everton are in the top 30, because whenever we talk about Everton Football Club, it's financial crisis, the manager's got no money to spend. So how do Everton sustain a position in the top 30?
Well, fundamentally, it's the fact that actually David Moyes has produced good results on the field, and therefore the television income from the Premiership. For the last 5 years, we've actually averaged, I think, fifth or sixth place in the Premiership, and that's been very important. The fans continue to turn up. I know there's been a bit of a disappointment recently, for example, at the Fulham Cup game, but the fans are there, and they continue to be loyal, the overwhelming majority of them. So to see them there in the top eight in England and the top 30 in Europe, I think might be a surprise to some, but it isn't a surprise to those who actually know what a good job the club is doing in so many areas.
Mm. But in terms of Everton as a business, you know, fans listening to this might think, well, if we are in the top eight clubs in the Premier League financially, why aren't we spending?
Well, the answer would be we are spending. I mean, it's not just over the January transfer window, which I think cheered a lot of people up. But the focus for the last few years has been very clearly keep people on the contract. So whether they've kept Fellaini or whether they've kept Rodwell or whether they've developed people like Rodwell, and of course Ross Barkley is coming through, and we've got a squad of very good young players coming through. And of course the developments at Finch Farm have been expensive, so there's a lot of investment. But let's be clear about it, and Liverpool are feeling it as well, if you're not in the Champions League, if you're not playing in Europe, that gap between what you have to spend and what you can invest, unless of course you've got a Sheikh Mansour or a Roman Abramovich who's willing to put an awful lot of money in. But of course the sheer amount which Sheikh Mansour is spending is a big deterrent to other people.
Will the deal that Liverpool recently announced on the shirt sponsorship be enough to compensate for the loss of Champions League football?
To put it simply, no, it's not. I mean, it's a very good deal. And actually, the reason why Liverpool are still in the top 10 is because they've cut a brilliant deal, not only with their new shirt sponsors, but their deal with Standard Chartered was an excellent deal. And the truth of the matter is they've done brilliantly in that, probably in terms of cutting deals, better than anyone else in the English Premiership.
Mm. And is that partly to do with Liverpool's international brand, the fact that they can actually have that worldwide global reach?
It's the Asian fan base which is so important. Liverpool, along with Manchester United, have clearly got the biggest Asian fan base. That's what attracts the Americans. If you look at American business, if you listen to what President Obama's saying, he's fixated on, we have to look to Asia, we have to look to China. And Liverpool not only are doing well in China, they're developing in India and have a brilliant academy program in Indonesia, which is a market that's enormous and a lot of people are ignoring.
And if we move away from Liverpool and go down the league, down the Premier League and also into the lower divisions, we've got still, I think I'm right in saying, 92 professional clubs in England. We have always managed to maintain the four divisions, rename them and rejig the way in which they operate with playoffs and so on and so forth. But I know that for a number of years now, you've been expressing concern, and you're not on your own, about whether or not that level of clubs is actually sustainable. And we've seen things like Southampton, Portsmouth, Leeds United, you know, big clubs really, you know, Premier League clubs, go into administration, financially struggle. Are we going to see a situation develop over the next few years where some of these clubs do simply just go out of business?
I think it's hard to see how these little clubs scattered around the country, struggling for attendances, clubs like Exeter City, Plymouth Argyle at one end of the country who are seeing 20% year-on-year declines in attendances, and at the other end of the country, clubs like Darlington who make an investment but just don't get a return on it. I find it very hard to see how they can remain on their present basis, which is fundamentally a full professional squad. I think they're either going to have to move to a regional division, the old third division or second division, north and south, or move to a position where a number of the players become semi-professional. Mm. I think that's almost inevitable. I also think there's a real risk that some of them will go beyond administration, will go into liquidation. Clearly, we've seen recently the Inland Revenue taking a very strict line. You know, in Scotland, they've got a case against Rangers. In England, they've gone back and they're going at Portsmouth again. And in Wales, it's not long since they had to go at Cardiff City. And of course, they clearly will be looking for an alternative to Harry Redknapp in terms of football, to look at in terms of why they believe football clubs are not, in a sense, pulling their weight in terms of tax.
Mm. Before I move on to the tax question, which I do want to pick up on today, but closer to home, Tranmere Rovers, how do you think they're faring at the moment?
Well, they're very fortunate in that Peter Johnson retains his commitment. I know Peter wants to sell and is looking for buyers, but in reality, there just aren't that many people around. It's not just times are tough for the likes of you and me, the man or woman in the streets, even for the rich, let's forget about the super rich for a minute, the willingness to go and underwrite a football club for year on year, without an awful lot of thanks, let's be honest. An awful lot of
the
people
at the
top.
The stick, don't they, the
they get the stick.
They very seldom get the praise. They get a lot of stick.
Everybody loves the manager when win.
Yeah.
Everyone loves the manager when they sign an ex-player who's come back from, let's say, Tottenham Hotspur. But you don't get that much praise if you happen to be the guy who missed a game because you were negotiating. You missed the Manchester City game, probably the only good performance of the club this season so far, because you're negotiating with the Tottenham chairman to get a player back.
Yeah. So you think Tranmere will be OK?
Yes, long as Peter
Certainly
Johnson's
in the short
there.
Term. Yeah. OK. You mentioned the Inland Revenue, Tom, and you know, I mean, there's two things I'll say about the Harry Redknapp case. The first is, I've always been a great believer in the phrase, slow justice is no justice. And it took 5 years to bring this particular prosecution to court, which I think for any individual, you know, take personalities aside, whether you love or hate the guy, that is an ordeal that nobody should have to go through. The second thing is that people will be looking at the figures produced. And I think they were talking about around £250,000. And it's cost us £8 million to prosecute. Now, first and foremost, is there any sort of common sense applied when the revenue and customs are looking at these cases? And the more fundamental point, I suppose, does football really need to start to get its own house in order to ensure that there is more transparency and understanding about how some of these transactions take place within the game?
Well, there are three points you make. First of all, the revenues defence was that actually that was £6 or 8 million to demonstrate that they are serious about chasing people who have offshore accounts and are trying to minimise or avoid their tax liabilities. So their view is it was symbolic more than anything. And that, OK, they lost, but they put a message out. You're absolutely right. Slow justice is no justice. And whatever way you look at the figures, to chase him for most £100,000 in terms of tax and then to spend £6 million to fail to get. And the truth of the matter is that he seems to have been straight on it. You know, the jury was clear that he was innocent and therefore the revenue have lost out and an innocent man has had to face five or six years of being chased about a relatively small sum. All of that. But it's clear that the revenue are uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable about two things. The thing that they are most uncomfortable about in football is the football debts get paid first rule. They don't like that. It used to be called crown privilege. They lost crown privilege some years ago and they feel it's wrong that in football, football debts are paid first. So that, let's say, Peter Crouch would be paid before the local Boys Brigade or St John's Ambulance. They think that's wrong. And secondly, they know that there are an awful lot of offshore transactions. There's an awful lot of questions about, for example, overseas earnings, about image rights, about media rights, and it is very loose. Now, I don't believe that the game as such can do anything about that because there are now so many parties, whether it's agents, whether it's players, whether it's media companies, whether it's the management within clubs, it's a complicated area. But football's also an easy target for the revenue because if they went for, say, a movie star or a singer, a lot of their work is overseas. Mm. So they can claim we earn that money overseas. Footballers play in the Premiership. They manage in the Premiership. So they can't claim that money was earned overseas, therefore we don't pay domestic taxes on it. So football's a good target, a high-profile target, but the revenue have got egg on their face.
And the FA, have they got a role to play to try and address some of the issues that you raised there in terms of the revenue's concerns?
I think there may well be a case that the FA, with the Premier League and with the PFA, need to get together, but I think it's almost impossible for football to sort this out on its own. I think maybe a closer examination, but candidly, compared to what's happening in some giant corporations, candidly, what's happening with some multi-million pound earning financial experts, I don't think football's that big a deal.
Mm. But as you say, high profile, sexy, it carries that sort of cachet, doesn't it? And that's why the likes of Redknapp were always going to be a target. But of course, it was a good day for him, wasn't it, really, Wednesday, because no sooner is he acquitted than Fabio Capello falls on his sword and resigns as England manager. Do you think it's almost inevitable now? The bookies seem to think so, that Harry is going to take over the England job?
I think it is almost inevitable, but I think he'd be crazy to do it because no one's ever ended up with finishing in the England job happy.
They always come into the job as heroes, don't they, and go out as dopes. You know, the only one actually I can think of who went out and people have still held him in high regard was, well, two actually, wasn't there? One was Terry Venables and one, I'm not going into beyond football, but I think as a football manager he was seen as somebody who'd done a positive job. And the other one eventually was Bobby Robson, but Robson suffered terribly at the hands of the press when he was England manager.
Absolutely. I mean, Bobby Robson really got his position in the affection of football, partly because of Ipswich and also because of Newcastle United. Mm. He was very badly treated by the press. I'm older than you see, Frank. I'll remember Walter Winterbottom. And I think he went out covered in glory, of course.
Well,
poor Alf Ramsey won a World Cup and got berated.
Yeah, still struggled. Well, listen, we've probably done football to death. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, elected mayors, the TNP, And our cruise liner terminal finally going to arrive? Stay with us. We'll be back just after this.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
And welcome back to the programme. I'm joined in the studio this week by Professor Tom Cannon and the Downtown Events Manager, Roger Jonas. We've been focusing on football. We're going to put the ball away now and talk about the decision that Liverpool City Council made on Tuesday evening. That was to approve proposals that will see the city have its first elected mayor from May. Tom, first of all, before we talk about the potential runners and riders, do you think this is a positive move for the city?
Very much so. I think the consensus has now grown in recent months that the city needs a strong symbol, a great communicator and someone who can mobilise, not just technically, but emotionally, the resources of this city region.
Mm. Roger?
Absolutely. I mean, you know that Downtown's been supportive of an elected mayor for many years. And I totally concur with what Tom's saying. You know, strong leadership, someone who's going to communicate and somebody who's going to, I guess, negotiate with Westminster, certainly in the way that we've recently seen, to enable this to happen. So, yeah, absolutely. I'm 100% behind it.
I suppose the important thing, as far as the administration was concerned, appears to have been this package that has been negotiated, which is some additional resources and certainly some additional powers. You know, these mayoral zones sound an interesting concept. More devolution of powers and responsibilities, I guess. So what about the person that should do the job? I mean, I've come out and said very publicly that I think Joe Anderson has done a great job as leader of the council for a couple of years. I think he deserves a crack at it. But he's got to, first of all, win the Labour Party nomination. Mm-hmm. And Ed Miliband has come out this week and said that he believes that we should adopt an American style for selecting the mayoral candidate, which is primaries. So rather than it just be the Labour Party membership in Liverpool, primaries would be held where anybody from those particular constituencies could come along, listen to what the candidates have to say and then vote. Tom, what do you think? Do you think Labour should just simply select Joe and he should be the person that carries their flag forward and face the other political parties that will no doubt get involved, the Lib Dems, the Conservatives and so on?
There's no doubt that Joe's done a good job, but I strongly believe in the notion of primaries. It worked in London, it generated an enormous amount of interest in London, and I think it worked in London when the candidates were there. I think it will also bring out potential candidates who won't come forward. I have different preferences. I'd love it to be a woman. I think one of the disappointments of this city is actually we don't have enough women in leadership positions. I think it'd be great if we had a female candidate. I think it would also be good if some of the other people who demonstrated an ability to achieve, the Phil Redmonds of this world, the Frank McKennas of this world, if they were coming forward, and I think it would make an exciting race.
Yeah, the media would have a field day, that's for sure. I'm just being told, actually, it's David Miliband,
that
mentioned the idea of primaries. I doubt very much whether the party in Liverpool will adopt that approach, actually. I think that they will rule that out. And I, you know, who knows, because politics is, as I will testify, an unpredictable game, to say the least. But my money would be on Joe Anderson to be the Labour Party candidate. Do you think people like Phil Redmond might throw the hat in, Tom, as an independent?
Well, there is a problem if he's, for example, a member of the Labour Party. I don't know, because you can't stand against the Labour Party candidate because then you get expelled from the party. It didn't completely block Ken Livingstone, of course. So he was then readopted within the party. So I think independent candidates would be a good idea. There are other great people. For example, we've got an obvious person, of course, Kenny Dalglish, who, like Dick Whittington, can bring his own cat.
It's Sunday morning and, you know, we're getting things like that thrown at us. Roger, what's your view? Just in terms of the sort of personalities, because Herbert Howe has thrown his hat in the ring. Liam Fogarty has said he's going to stand.
I've got to say this with Herbert. A great PR idea. I don't think it would stand a cat in hell's chance. And it is good publicity for him, I guess. But I think he's one of those kind of celebrity names that is gonna milk it for all it's worth, I have to say. But I, you know, again, you've got to look at what Joe's achieved, I guess, in the last 2 years, the last 18 months. You know, and he has got all the qualities, I think, that are required. I'm not convinced that Phil Redmond would make a particularly good candidate, in the pure sense that I'm not sure he's had that kind of political experience. He's a great orator. He does have an opinion. He's a very successful businessman, setting up Mersey Television and you know, massively successful. But I'm not sure that he's had the necessary political experience, and Herbert Howe certainly hasn't.
Where would the excitement be if Joe stood against the leader of the Lib Dems and the Tories got another party person? There's no excitement there. Mm. There's none of the energy which certainly we've seen in London and we've seen in Middlesbrough and we've seen in other places. It would be another three-way party battle, and the reaction locally, I think, would be a fairly small yawn, and the reaction in Westminster mm-hmm. would be a very big yawn. Mm-hmm. And for all Joe's strengths, I don't see him as a great communicator.
I think it's going to be interesting because of the short time scale that exists between now and the election, to see if anybody actually feels as though they've got the wherewithal to put together a campaign team, get the resources that are required to fight that campaign. And you are rightly pointing out there, Tom, that the political parties, they have machines in place, so they will be ready to go, and May is the time that they fight elections anyway. So I think there's an advantage to the mainstream political parties. I also wonder whether there's an appetite within the city to, given where we are, take a punt on, you know, an independent candidate who hasn't got that breadth of experience in the political world. Maybe going forward, you may actually see other names emerge. But I'll tell you the interesting thing, that we've had a conversation there for a few minutes about potential candidates. You made the point, Tom, you'd like to see a female candidate. We've none of us mentioned one. And Lorraine Rogers has resigned from the Mersey Partnership this week as chief executive. I mean, again, listeners will know that my views of the Mersey Partnership is that as an organisation, its time had been and gone. But nonetheless, a talented individual who made a contribution to Merseyside and seems to be suggesting, actually, I'm leaving the stage.
Well, it's all tied up, of course, with the developments around the Learning and Enterprise Partnership. And as that wise philosopher comedian Oliver Hardy once said, this is another fine mess. And the truth is that the Learning and Enterprise Partnership so far, and I think Robert Huff, who...
The Local Enterprise Partnership.
Sorry, I said learning, didn't I? I keep hoping for learning. It's probably the academic in me. I keep throwing in the word learning in this kind of... We'd learn from past errors. But the Local Enterprise Partnership streets hasn't gone well at all. And whatever's happened around Lorraine's position, I think, has been a mess. And I think the sooner that mess is sorted out, the sooner, I hope, Robert Huff takes firm control over it and, in a sense, depoliticises it, the better. And I don't think it makes any of the politicians look good, what's happened around there.
As you say, we've not really got a great number of females involved in those senior positions locally. I mean, I have to point out, to be fair, three of our five MPs are female. But within the local authority, local government sphere, there aren't that many. In fact, other than Lorraine, I can't think of any high-profile, powerful women.
Well, if I talk to my friend Maggie O'Carroll, who runs the women's organisation, she'd probably say that the women are too busy doing the job. And therefore, I think an awful lot of the people who are working... I'd have liked to have seen one of the Eagle sisters put themselves forward as a potential mayor. I think that would be... open up the candidature. This is a city which I've always seen, you know, when I was a lad, it was a matriarchy. The truth is, women have always played crucial roles in our city, particularly when men were in casual labour. The city had a casual labour force, often transient labour force. It was the women who held the city together. And I think it's unfortunate that we've not recognised that in the past. And it will be sad if we don't recognise it in the future.
Mm. And, you know, if we look further afield to the city region, then you've got people like Mary Rimmer in St Helens. And then if you look just down the road, the M62 in Salford, the chief executive is Scouser. It's Barbara Spicer, mm-hmm. who does a fabulous job there. Some good news for the city this week was the fact that we are finally, it seems, going to get this turnaround facility that has been talked about for a while now. Roger, you know, from the tourism perspective, I would suggest that this is a far more important development than, for example, World Heritage status that we keep hearing about. So, you know, good news again. Hotels, bars, restaurants.
Excellent news, and already, you know, working closely with a lot of the hotels in the city, they're delighted. It opens vast opportunities for tourism. My only concern is that we're used to, I guess, coach loads of people arriving in the city, getting on a boat boats arriving, getting onto coaches and disappearing off, you know, to various of things around the northwest. The Chester Zoo gets a really good hit. Lancashire gets a good hit. Liverpool, they just seem to pass through. And I just worry that we might have got that wrong slightly, that we're not going to benefit as much as maybe people think they are. If it goes ahead, you know, as I say, the word on the street is that the hoteliers are excited about it. There's a lot of things happening in the city to attract tourism. The Sea Odyssey is about to take place. We've got the GEC that's about to take place. Not necessarily people are going to come in on boats to experience these events, but it's a massive tick for the city. I just hope we get it right. I hope we haven't got it wrong. I guess that's what I'm saying. They're saying that each boat is worth £1 million to us. I'm not too sure about
that. Well, I think what, you know, they would accept is that it is going to be a city region attraction. You know, it's not simply a facility that's there that's going to benefit the Liverpool on its own. And in fact, you know, one of the big arguments, but we go back to the elected mayor debate, is whether or not that position should have covered the whole of Liverpool city region and taking in places like Knowsley, Sefton, the Wirral and so on. Unfortunately, they couldn't get agreement across the political parties or political
leaders. It was only two areas, wasn't it?
I think it was St Helens and Wirral.
Wirral,
that weren't in favour. Yeah. But there will be benefits to those.
But I think it's also, it's that getting used to it. Mm. I think it's having the confidence that actually something as a grand scale as this is going to work, and it's the settling down period. You know, Tom mentioned before about Joe, you know, he didn't think Joe was particularly a good communicator. I think we've all seen Joe's confidence grow over the last 2 years, especially as a public speaker. And I guess it's the same. You have to have that settling in period. So, you know, whether we have a city mayor or a regional elected mayor, you know, whether or not the turnaround facility down on the waterfront works, we've got to give it time. Mm. We've got to allow
it. Oh, we have. And I think that, you know, the only concern that people might have is that you would probably have seen the Mersey Partnership as the organisation that would have pulled together the marketing activities for that new turnaround facility. That is something now, I guess, that Liverpool Vision are going to have to pick the cultural.
Yeah, but I've got to say, I've never seen the Mersey Partnership do anything, really.
Mm. I think on tourism.
I haven't seen that, and I wonder how many people have, and I've always said that they need to be more transparent.
Yeah, but then you wonder whether or not, you know, it's the job of the organisation that's doing the marketing to market itself. So I think that, you know, in terms of visitor economy and in terms of tourism, my view is that TMP did a decent job, or are doing a decent job. Lorraine's gone, the organisation still remains. But I do think that there may be a bit of a vacuum now. And surely, you know, now she has gone, now the head of that organisation has gone, it is time for us to review whether or not we need TMP alongside Liverpool Vision and all the other agencies that are here. That's a conversation that we can continue after this short break.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
And welcome back to the programme. We've unfortunately lost one of our guests, Professor Tom Cannon, who's had to go home and cook Sunday lunch. But we do still have the ubiquitous Roger Jonas in the studio with us. And we're just musing over what effect Lorraine Rodgers' departure as the chief executive of the Mersey Partnership may have on the tourism visitor sector in Liverpool. And looking ahead, Roger, we've got some major, major things happening in the city. The Global Entrepreneurship Congress. We have the Matthew Street Festival, which is going to be celebrating the 50th year of the Beatles this year.
And the 20th anniversary of the Matthew Street Festival.
And the 20th
happens,
of the festival itself.
Yeah.
We've then got the Sea Odyssey that you've mentioned.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we've got all the things that, that always happen on an annual basis, you know, the likes of the Grand National. So given the fact that the City Council are facing cutbacks, you've got, you know, TMP now clearly in a position where they are at this moment in time, at the very least, going to be lacking in terms of direction and management. Are we in a position where we can market these things effectively? You know, how do you think, for example, the GEC stuff is going?
I think everybody's aware that the GEC is coming. I think Vision have done a good, solid job in a relatively short space of time as well, with something of that scale, to pull it together. The logistics of I guess, an event on that scale are enormous. And I think more recently it's really come together. Maybe they could have made a bit more of telling people earlier on what the wish list was. I always struggle with this, you know, you wait until everything's confirmed before you get it out there. You know, we can be guilty of that ourselves. It's confidence that you're going to be able to deliver what you say you're going to deliver, but they've done it. Kicks off 12th of March till the 16th. And you know, I think one of the key things that it's going to do is glue the business community together during that week. They've got to get that week right, though. I think that's the point now. And they've got to tell the story. And as I was saying to you just before, you know, with the Mersey Partnership, I've always struggled with the lack of information that they get out to us to let us know what they've been doing with our money, essentially. I know Lorraine has maintained for a while that they are a private sector organisation. I would tend to disagree with that and happily argue the toss there. But it's about getting it right. It's about being transparent, letting everybody know that it was a great success, that it is a great success, or actually that it hasn't worked. Mm. You know, not everything needs to work.
Yeah. I think the GEC is shaping up to be a fantastic festival, really, isn't it? A celebration of enterprise. And, you know, when you've got people like Branson, Sir Terry Leahy, Michael Heseltine, and a number of other people, of course, on the panel that will be speaking, particularly there are 2 days to focus at the arena. But then we've got an array of fringe events that people are being encouraged to host. And downtown, I think we've come up with a cracking event for that week, which we've called Global Brands, Global People.
Yeah, that's going to be on the 15th of March at the Hilton Hotel. It's a breakfast event. And it is just that. We're focusing on successful businesses that have grown and have a global appeal. So we've got Ian Eyre, who's the managing director of Liverpool Football Club. I had to bring that in because we spent so much time talking about Everton Football Club. Can't imagine why. I just sat in awe of Professor Tom Cannon and his knowledge. He's a proper nerd, and I'm glad he's not here. But Ian Eyre, managing director. We've got James Barton, who set up Cream in Liverpool, which has gone absolutely AWOL in terms. I mean, it's amazing. It is a massive global brand. You can't go anywhere.
Well, they do events as far as South America. I think he's getting into the Asian market now. Yeah, I mean, he is, you know, that
who
is a global brand.
Yeah, that is a global brand, isn't it? Enormous. Gavin Wilden, remind me of his company, Frank.
Applied Language Solutions. Yeah. Gavin has just done a deal with Capita to sell his business, which will probably eventually end up worth in excess of £60 million.
Yeah.
So Gavin is definitely somebody who's worth listening to from a business perspective. I mean, the great thing about Gavin, I'm going to try and get him on the show within the next couple of weeks, is a very down-to-earth lad, obviously built an extremely successful business. It's translation services that he provides, and he provides translation services all over the world. But the great thing about Gavin is his story, which is he started the business off in his back bedroom, and at one stage he had £47,000 worth of debt on his credit card, on a multiple of credit cards, obviously not on one. I don't think even Barclay card would give me that sort of credit limit. So £47,000 worth of debt, backed himself, and he's ended up selling the company within the last few weeks for, you know, a significant amount of cash. So what a great story, and what a great inspiration. And to have somebody like that, so that's a new brand that's gone global. Then we've got established brands like Liverpool Football Club, Cream. Yeah. We're hoping to have Google along as well.
Yeah.
Jaguar are probably going to be there on the day. Lombard, who, again, you know, finance all over the world, businesses all across the globe. So I think that's going to be a fantastic event. And then there are things happening right across the city during that week that people can get involved in. And if you want details of anything and everything that is going on during Global Entrepreneurship Congress Week, then do contact us via our website, www.downtownliverpool.com, because we will have all the information. And as I say, among the speakers, Richard Branson, Sir Terry Leahy, Michael Heseltine. Sticking with Heather for a moment and going back to the political debate and discussion, it was announced this week that he's going to be given the freedom of the city.
He can drive sheep through the city centre past the town hall.
Again, you know, some people have said what a fantastic gesture that is, a Labour council giving a Tory an accolade of that type. Other people who were around in the 80s, I mean, our old mate Degsy, for example, is saying, well, actually, he doesn't deserve it because he just helped to do Thatcher's dirty work for her. Where do you stand on the issue?
It's a hard one, that, wasn't it? I lived in Chester in the 80s, and we got a lot of the overspill of the news that was coming out, and I think a lot of people over that side took a wide berth from Liverpool, really, to be honest. The riots didn't help, obviously. I think Heseltine worked wonders in helping to rebuild the city, and he's always loved the city ever since. He spent a lot of time here. He visits when he can. He gets involved, and I think that needs to be recognised. He's a very, very influential man, massively successful businessman in his own right, so he understands what it takes for business to work. And I guess of all of them, he's treated Liverpool City as a business. So he's allowed, you know, he's been very supportive. I know him and Terry Leahy produced the report last year. I guess we're still seeing sort of ripple effects of that. No, I don't have an issue with him being awarded this. And, you know, I think he's getting on a bit as well. So I guess if it's not now, I think it says a lot for the Labour leadership as well, I have to say.
I think it was a good move. I mean, I think he deserves it. He's been involved and interested in the city now since the early 80s.
Yeah.
So it's not as if you can say, well, he's a fly-by-night. You know, he's really taken a genuine interest.
He's passionate.
And he genuinely loves the city. Yeah. I mean, when he's spoken at our events, and we've been fortunate enough to have him to a couple of things that we've done, it's clear that his knowledge of Liverpool is comprehensive. Mm. He stayed in touch with the city throughout those 30 years or whatever it is. And, you know, the great thing for me is that you've now got a Conservative government And for many years, Liverpool has found itself out of step with the national politics. So when we had a Labour government for 13 years, we had a Lib Dem council.
Yeah.
We've now got a Conservative Lib Dem government and we've got a Labour council. And I think this helps in terms of demonstrating very clearly that...
It's kind of that balance, isn't
it? Yeah, you can put the political badges away. You know, if you've got individuals that are prepared to stand up and articulate a case for Liverpool, which Heseltine does on a regular basis, then I think it's right that that is acknowledged and recognised. And there's only a limited amount of things that councils can do. So, you know, freedom of the city, I mean, in a sense, it doesn't mean a massive amount. But what it does do is it says to Heseltine, we appreciate what you've done for us.
Thank you, and the effort that you've made.
And
I know you said before about put the political badges away, but what else could Degsy say, really, to be honest? Because I think during the 80s, he might have had just a little bit of an issue with the Tories. He may have had a bit of an issue.
People always get the history mixed up here, because when the riots happened, Sir Trevor Jones was leader of Liverpool and the Lib Dems were in charge. So militant Labour didn't take charge of the city until 84, 85, I think it was. Certainly after the riots. Maybe in 83. And therefore, Heseltine was already here.
Yeah.
And working with the Liberal administration, as it would have been then, before Derek Hatton became deputy leader of the council. So, you know, as I say, people always attach the riots to the time when Millen were in charge here, and that's not the case. I was surprised, actually, at Derek Hatton's comments, because I always thought that he was pragmatic enough to recognise that, you know, Heseltine, whatever your thoughts of the Conservative Party at the time, was somebody who did two things, really. He stood up for Liverpool, and I think he stood up against Margaret Thatcher. I mean, if you looked around that cabinet table at the time, there weren't many individuals who were prepared to take her on. And Heseltine did. And again, not so long back, only a few weeks ago, government papers were released, this 30-year rule. And Geoffrey Howe was actually arguing that Liverpool should be managed into decline and forgotten about. Now, Heseltine came in, and whatever you think about the measures he took, what he didn't do was manage decline. You know, he did try and regenerate and rejuvenate the city.
Doesn't that show you? Doesn't that show you? I mean, you have to almost live here to recognise the change in Liverpool. For Geoffrey Howe to say that, for me, that's evidence that the Tories down south are so out of touch with actually what's going on here. And they're probably responding to recent events, you know, with Joe and you know, the big society and all that. I struggle with that massively.
But it was said, you know, and again, you know, I suppose, again, what the Conservative Party will say is, well, yeah, Geoffrey Howe said that, but it was never a policy that was implemented. And as I say, I think Heseltine did do a great job. One of his proposals, again, we'll just finish on this because we've discussed it briefly earlier, was an elected mayor before the city region. Interesting what Tom Cannon was saying there, wasn't he, about actually what he would have liked to have seen was some excitement injected into the race for elected mayor. And, you know, he wants to see, I don't know, I think Tom would like to see Ken Dodd and Cilla Black and a few more throw their hat in. Yeah. And certainly a big advocate of Phil Redmond there. My view of this is, look, Liverpool has had a period for the last few years and, you know, the last administration as well, where at least the political leadership, whether you agree with the party politics or not, has been taken seriously, has been fairly stable. And I just think that from the wider UK perspective, for Liverpool to maintain the momentum that it's gained and to be taken seriously by the rest of the country, the last thing we need to do, actually, is elect a novelty candidate.
Yeah. This is not a showboat. Liverpool's not a showboat. Let the creative people do the creative stuff and let the politicians do the political stuff. Because if we don't have strong political leadership, as we've said before, Westminster, they run the country, we run Liverpool, and it's got to be political strong leadership. Otherwise, we don't want celebrities. We don't want the showboat. it needs to be someone with that mind.
I would agree with that, Rog, but if you don't agree with us, then let us know, and we'll no doubt have other guests on the programme who have an alternative view over the coming weeks. And that's it from me, Frank McKenna, and City Talks Business for another Sunday. Thanks to my guests, thanks to my producer, Jonathan Dean, and most of all, thank you for listening. Have a great week, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. Listen and log on to great music and great conversation on City Talk 105.9.